Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in East St. Louis, Illinois, and earned a Bachelor of Educational Science in Counseling Psychology degree from the University of Missouri while becoming an All-American football player. The 13th player drafted in the 1979 NFL Draft, he played 9 seasons for the San Diego Chargers. Elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1995, he transformed the tight end position. His name? Kellen Winslow Senior, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Kellen Winslow Sr., who in 1995 was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Quite an honor.
Very much an honor. Quite a surprise, too.
Can we start, Kellen, by talking about your childhood in East St. Louis, Illinois, and your mom and your dad, please?
Wow. East St. Louis, Illinois. I was born in 1957. Technically, I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, because in 1957, African Americans had to go to the hospital on the Missouri side of the river. You could not go to, my mother could not go to the hospitals in East St. Louis, Illinois to give birth. So I think I was the last of her 7 children. I was number 3, who was born in St. Louis. And I think a year and a half later, when my brother was born, he was the first one born actually in East St. Louis, Illinois. Just give a little context of what we're talking about, how old I really am. When I grew up in East St. Louis, Illinois, a city right now that's going through a lot of changes and a lot of transitions, much like Detroit, much like Flint, much like any city on a river who had to change and make that transition from manufacturing to something else. And we're still trying to figure out what that something else is besides riverboat, casino, gambling. 2 family homes, mother and dad in the home, bunch of kids running up and down the street. We were the 3rd, I do believe, family of color to move on 22nd Street, with my grandparents being probably the 2nd family of color to move on 22nd Street during that time of white flight in East St. Louis, Illinois. My father was the 1st of 2 people of color to become employees of Bi-State Transit, the regional transit authority in East St. Louis and St. Louis, Missouri, thus Bi-State. They crossed the river. And that set the tone for him and my mother raising a family of 7 children in a very, you know, religious background with their grandparents, our grandparents right down the street, and my mother's sister and her husband and their 9 or 10 kids right down the street also.
What's the biggest thing, Kellen, mom taught you, and what's the biggest thing dad taught you?
The biggest thing my father taught me was hard work and commitment. You know, he got up every day, went to work. He did what it was required to do to raise a family of 7 children, a wife and 7 kids, and what started off to be a 2-bedroom house and a 1-bath house and ended up being a 2.5-bathroom house with 4 bedrooms and a 2-car garage attached. So he taught me about hard work and commitment. My mother taught me the love and compassion side of it all. I really can't remember telling my father I love him until I went to college, when I really got a chance to explore who I am. And we really talked about affection. You knew your dad loved you. You knew it. You never questioned it. He punished you. He told you. He took you places. We went to St. Louis Cardinal baseball games. But the actual showing of that affection and speaking those words, I don't remember doing that until I went to college and really realized that I'm a touchy-feely person. And I think he was very uncomfortable with that at first, but quickly became very comfortable with it. But my mother and all my sisters that I was raised with and my aunts and grandparents, that love and compassion came from that side.
You were a self-described nerd who played chess in high school. and didn't play football till your senior year. How did you ever get the love for chess?
Well, necessity. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. One summer when we were growing up in East St. Louis, Illinois, this church, of all things, moved in and took our playground to build a church on our playground. I mean, sacrilege, come on. And so we had no place to play sandlot baseball. So we got tired of playing cards. We used to play this game called Knuckles, where you lose and they ball the cards up into a knuckle and into a wad, hit your hand. We got tired of that rather quickly. So we played cards for push-ups, for knucks, whatever. But one of the older guys in my neighborhood brought out a chess set. And he taught all of us in my neighborhood how to play chess. And that's how we spent the good deal of that summer until the next summer we found another place to have our baseball games. But I was taught with my cousins and with my friends. And when I was on the chess team in high school, it was made up of my cousins and my friends from my street.
What do chess and football have in common, Kellen Winslow?
It's the same thing, Jack. When I realized that chess and football are the same thing, I began to understand football because I knew chess. I remember thinking that when, you know, you've got a finite space to work in and you've got pieces on the board that have certain talents and other pieces don't, and you've got to use those pieces in a very judicious way, and you've got to make things happen. You have to have some strategy. And when I realized that football was nothing but chess, I understood football. The whole world opened up to me. I understood what I did, not only what I did, but I understood why I did it. And understood what everybody else did, and understood what their roles were. And it made me a better football player.
A little more than a month ago, we lost a legend, an icon, the greatest, Muhammad Ali. What did Ali mean to you as a young African-American growing up? And what did he teach you, Kellen Winslow?
I had the opportunity, the blessing, to actually sit back-to-back with Muhammad Ali at a fundraiser in Los Angeles. He was there, of course. He was showing the early signs of his disease, and his good friend Howard Bingham was right there with him as his photographer. And while whoever the speaker was speaking, it might have been Gerald Ford. It was Gerald Ford, exactly. It was Gerald Ford at a fundraiser in Los Angeles. I'm sitting back-to-back to Muhammad Ali. Everybody's coming over and bothering Ali. But when Gerald Ford got up to speak, he turned to me and he started whispering stuff to me, you know, because he was a joker. Mm-hmm. And I guess he just wasn't into what the former president was saying. And so we just had a good time. And there were some pictures taken that Howard has, I'm sure, somewhere in his files of all of us together. But what he meant to us was everything. He showed us courage. And I didn't think about it at the time, but you know, when I was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I took a very strong stance on the lack of opportunities for people of color in professional sports and on the collegiate level also. I took a lot of flack for that, but I knew it was the right thing to do. I knew at the time that it was going to be criticized, but I didn't care because it had to be said and that conversation had to start. And from that, I think we've had some improvements, but I can't take credit for it. I'm not going to do a Donald Trump and take credit for it. I'm just going to say that I'm pretty sure that's where that came from, that strength to do it and the seeing the necessity of getting it done.
We're talking to Kellen Winslow Sr., and I'm Jack Grasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Grasula. We're with Kellen Winslow Sr., who went to the University of Missouri and became an All-American football player. And there was a Dr. Walter Daniel that really made an impression on you in those years. Tell us about Dr. Walter Daniel.
We are only as good as the people around us. We really are. You can look at the people who are surrounding an individual, and you can really take a look at their potential, what they're going to be able to do. Dr. Daniel was one of those individuals for me, one of those five people who have a great impact on your life. Had nothing to do with football except for the fact that it was at the University of Missouri is where we met. He took me under his wing, and really he was my English African-American literature professor, and he taught me how to think. how to read, how to interpret. Not just to take the words on the page, but what is the writer really talking about? And what do you think the writer's talking about? How does this relate to what you are in your situation, your circumstance? So he just really broadened my mind. He was the highest ranking person of color in the University of Missouri system at the time. Now, at the University of Missouri, we're talking about Kansas City, St. Louis, Columbia, at the time RALA, which is now called Missouri Institute of Technology, I do believe, or a technology institute. But he was the highest ranking individual in that system of color. And to have access to him and to actually get a chance to work for him one off season during the Christmas break doing some research projects, I learned a lot about how the university system works and about how you get things done within that. And I learned a great deal about research. But he really made me think, and he planted the idea of going to law school way before I realized that he had. And when I thought it was my idea, it was really years of him dropping that thought somewhere in our conversations until one day I really said, okay, I'm going to go to law school when I retire. And I called him up and said, okay, I heard you. He just laughed. He said, I thought you would eventually.
And in 1993, you got a law degree from the University of San Diego School of Law.
USD. Go Toreros.
You graduate from Missouri and you become the 13th pick by the San Diego Chargers in the 1979 NFL draft.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this coach, Air Coryell, Don Coryell. Tell us about that coach.
Don Coryell is a player's coach. He wants to coach. That's all he wants to do. He didn't want to be involved in contracts. He didn't want to be involved in how the team gets from point A to point B. He was an X and O guy, a motivator, an innovator. Don Coryell changed the face of professional football. When one morning in a meeting, I was told it was about 2 a.m., he made the declaration when Joe Gibbs was in the room, Ernie Zampezi, Jim Hanifin were all in the room watching film. And Coryell, they were concerned about how do we get this young tight end we've got from Missouri who's not physically developed yet, but's got some skills. How do we get him on the field? Coryell haphazardly probably said, take out the fullback and put Kellen in. He can do that stuff. The two tight end formation is born. It changed the face of football. It's what you're watching today. It's what Gronkowski is doing. It's what Antonio Gates does. It's that movement that's taking advantage of an athlete on someone who's not very good in space, or they're good in space, meaning a safety, a bigger body on a smaller body. It's a mismatch, and it changed the game of football.
They used to say about you that you were a world-class receiver in a lineman's body.
Was that my mother who said that? No, Al Saunders. I was taken in Missouri as a tight end, and they really didn't throw the ball a lot. I was in a wishbone offense in high school. I didn't know you could throw the ball to the tight end on a regular basis. You know, that was news to me. But when we were in practice, I was usually the only tight end out there, especially off-season workouts. So I went and ran with the wide receivers. I ran their routes. I did their thing. They were smaller and quicker, and I realized I could do the same thing. And eventually, coaches saw that and said, well, maybe we should throw this kid the ball. But when I got to San Diego, the first thing Don Coryell said to me, when I got off the plane and Tank Younger picked me up, the executive, Tank Younger, great man, God rest his soul, Tank picked me up and drove me to the stadium and said, here's your home for the next 10 years. And my first meeting with Coryell, he didn't say hello. He didn't say, how was your flight? He said, how would you like to play some wide receiver? I'm in.
Greatest uniform in the history of sports, right?
We think so. The Raiders may, complain about that. The Colts, they have a legitimate claim to it. The Giants have a legitimate claim to that greatest uniform. But people seem to like that combination for the Chargers.
You had Dan Fouts, Hall of Fame quarterback. Charlie Joyner, Hall of Fame receiver, yourself Hall of Fame receiver, John Jefferson, Wes Chandler, Eric Sivers, you had a phenomenal passing attack.
We did. And what really made it work was that offensive line. That offensive line of Russ Washington, Ed White, Donnie Masick, Doug Wilkerson, and Billy Shields, that was a unit that was together for about seven consecutive years. And that's what made it work. I don't care how good your quarterback is, if he's on his butt, or if he's running for his life, he can't do his job. So it starts up front. Then we had a quarterback who trusted his wide receivers, who trusted his receivers, period. And that includes the running back. Now, remind you, we had James Brooks on that team for a while. and Chuck Muncy. Mike Thomas, who played for Washington, who came out to play for the Chargers, who was known as that combination receiving and running back combo. It was a great school. I mean, it was a great team to be on. But what was a blessing for me was that I was the last piece of the puzzle of putting that offense together. I wasn't the first piece. I wasn't the savior of the offense. I wasn't drafted number two, and they expect me to come in and do all these things. You're only as good as the people around you, and I was surrounded by great talent.
Your son went to University of Miami, played for the Browns as a tight end, and your roommate as a rookie in San Diego was Russell Wilson's dad. What did
Harry,
they feed you in that room?
Harry Wilson. We called him the professor. Now, here's a circuitous route to the NFL. Harry had gone to Hampton University, graduated, went to the University of Virginia School of Law, then got a tryout, graduated from there, then got a tryout with the San Diego Chargers. He happened to be my roommate during that time. Harry would have made the Balt club, except for the Chargers had a different way of counting at positions. So instead of being six wide receivers, they only kept five. I was the sixth wide receiver. So we kept three tight ends, and we moved everybody around, so we interchanged the puzzle. If we had been a traditional team that kept three tight ends and six wide receivers, then Harry would have made that ball club and would have contributed for us. Good man. We called him the professor. Love him and miss him to this day.
We're talking to Kellen Winslow Sr. When we come back, we're going to talk about one of the most famous games in the history of football that occurred on January 2nd, 1982. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crisula, and we're with Kellen Winslow Sr. Let's go back, Kellen, January 2nd, 1982. Tell us about the epic in Miami.
I don't remember much about that.
You probably get asked about this every day of your life.
And it's okay, because we won the game. If we had not won the game, it would be that albatross around everybody who played for the Chargers' neck, because I'm sure they hear about that game just as much. It was hot. It really was hot. The night before, I think Clemson had beat Nebraska, or Nebraska beat Clemson. No, Clemson beat Nebraska January 1st, 1982, to win the national championship. Of course, they went on probation like 2 weeks later for recruiting violations. And then we come out on the field and we take on the Miami Dolphins. There was so much to that game. I could probably go play by play and probably do commentary if somebody put it up and we talked about this, talked about that. But what I remember most about that ball game is what happened before the game started, the night before. We were in a chapel service, and the question was, does God decide who wins football games? Now, I want you to imagine, you know, there are some people from FCA there, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and it's a room full of football players, and we're having this debate that, of course, theologians and philosophers deal with all the time. After some back and forth, the conclusion was that as believers, our job was to go out and to play the best of our ability and give the praise to where it belongs, because we have these God-given abilities. So I went to bed wondering that night if I'd ever played in a game where I had given all I had. Next day, less than 24 hours later, here's the challenge. And it was back and forth. We go up 21-0, I do believe, on the Dolphins. And before halftime, you know, we're just really rolling, doing well. And at halftime, it's 24-21, Chargers. And Dan Fouts comes into the locker room and throws his helmet right through the chalkboard. They didn't have digital at that time. There was no iPad in the room. It was a chalkboard. And he threw his helmet right through the chalkboard. And I'm sure we covered their expenses later. And told the offense that they had never stopped us. We stopped ourselves as an offense. He said, get yourself together, because we're going to go back out there and, you know, we're going to have to do some things that we, you know, we need to get back to doing what we do. Moving the ball down the field, putting points on the board. And sure enough, the game went back and forth, back and forth. I went into that ball game, to kind of be brief about this, weighing about 248, came out weighing 236. And that's with a lot of preparation on the hydration side and, you know, taking care of yourself physically, drinking plenty of water and juices before the game, during the game. But the Dolphins just really whooped my butt. They really did.
13 catches, 166 yards receiving. 4 seconds left to go in the game. It's tied score. Their kicker, I think, had not missed a field goal all year.
Uwe Von Schaumann, University of Oklahoma.
What happened?
I was trying to go to the bathroom, and the coach said, no, you can do that later. I'm kidding. During those days before, ironically, Coach Shula, part of the competition's rule committee, changed the rule, I was the leaper. And you can leap over the top. Now, I don't have a great vertical. I just happen to be 6'5" and a quarter inch tall. So they thought I should be able to jump with that height. And in my mind, I was Michael Jordan soaring over the top, waiting for the ball to come up so I can swat it down and look down upon them and going, ha, we blocked your kick. But when you watch the film, I think you can take a credit card and turn it sideways and you can't get it under my feet.
I think Bill Laimbeer could jump higher at the end of that game.
Exactly. Bill, but I thought I was soaring. And in the huddle, it was Leroy Jones, Louis Kelcher, Gary Johnson, and Fred Dean up front. And Wilbur Young was a part of that. And Leroy Jones is 6'8". Matter of fact, he blocked the second field goal in that game. And we're in the huddle, and they're not used to me being in that huddle because we just walk through it. We never practice it. You just walk through it. And I'm telling the guys, give me some penetration, I'll get it. Give me some penetration. I'm just talking stuff because they're about to win this ball game, and we're going to be part of the biggest collapse in NFL history, and I want no part of that. So give me some penetration. And they got some penetration, and I attempted to time it and run up there and jump, and it hit my little finger on my right hand, and just enough to slow down the distance, but not the accuracy. He was right down the middle, but it came up short. And when I blocked it, I knew I had blocked it. I didn't know if it was going to go through or not. But it's probably probably my proudest sports moment playing for professional football.
And that was the epic in Miami. Let's jump ahead to 1995. You get elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. There's only 303 players in that very exclusive club. What does it mean to be part of that club?
Jack, I'm still trying to figure that out. It's just, you can't put it into words. And people say, well, you're just, just posturing. It's a pride thing. No, it really is difficult to put into perspective. Those numbers, there's probably been, 20,000 people who've played professional football since the beginning of football, now almost 100 years old. And there's 303 of us. Mm-hmm. And they have 4 or 5 a year. And here's a guy who almost did not play football at all, if not for his high school coach, because I only played 1 year of football my senior year of high school. And there I am. And it's hard to put into words. I'm humbled by it. I am not worthy of the honor, but I accept it because it's a blessing.
You were drafted in 79. I think there were 7 rounds of 30 teams each. Dan Hampton, the 4th pick. Bears, Football
yes.
Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
You're the 13th pick,
right?
Hall of Fame, and the 3rd Hall of Famer from that class,
mm-hmm.
with the 87th pick, was a kid from Notre Dame, Joe Montana.
Joe Montana, yeah, Joe. It was that was a strange draft. And back in 1979, it was just before ESPN became ESPN. So there wasn't a lot of live coverage, wasn't a big deal as far as the nation. Well, to me it was, but to the rest of the nation, it's like, okay, what happened? I can read it in the paper. The first pick was Cousineau,
yes.
The linebacker out of Ohio State, who ended up playing in Canada for a couple of years before coming back and playing with the Bills. And the second pick was Dan Hampton. Third pick, which the so-called experts at the time said would be Kellen Winslow to Cincinnati, the tight end out of Missouri. They didn't know what they were talking about. I fell from the so-called 3rd pick in the draft to the 13th pick, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me, to go to the San Diego Chargers, who traded up from the 20th pick to the 13th pick with the Cleveland Browns. And then they drafted me and put me into that great offense, and I always wanted to go to San Diego. Because I wanted to play in warm weather. And I knew a great deal about Don Coryell as his, because he was a coach in St. Louis Cardinals. So it was just a great fit for me.
July 29th, 1995, Canton, Ohio is the actual induction date. When you get in, you get to choose a presenter. And Kellen, you choose Cornelius Perry as your presenter. Who was he and why did you choose him?
Coach Perry. You know, I didn't. Is his first name Cornelius?
Yes.
Okay. So we always know him as Coach Perry, and some people called him Corny because, you know, short for Cornelius, but it's to me, it is and always will be Coach Perry. Coach Perry came to my geometry class at the end of my junior year with Coach Jimmy Lewis, his assistant, and the head track coach, and they convinced me to come out for football my senior year. I was in my geometry class, and they said to the teacher, can we see Mr. Winslow? And at the time, I was working after school at UPS. I came out to the hallway, and they changed the direction of my life. They really did. They told me that they saw me do things in their gym class, because they were both gym teachers also. And I was doing things in their gym class. They were trying to teach other kids to do, and I do it kind of instinctively, and I catch the ball. And I'm looking at them like, yeah, I got to go to work. They dragged me down the hallway to the principal, Mr. Morgan. And Mr. Morgan, who my parents knew well, said, Kellen, you're Donna's brother. Because that's how I was known. I was Donna's brother. Because Donna was always into something at school. And good and bad. So it worked out. They said I had a talent that I didn't realize I had. And I believed them. I took a leave of absence from UPS that following fall. Came out for football, and it changed my life.
There's a famous luncheon every induction weekend in Canton. On mm-hmm. Friday, the Ray Nitschke Luncheon.
Yes.
Players only, I think.
Players only, yes.
Can you share anything about this famous luncheon?
I have to get you to sign a non-disclosure, then I have to kill you after you do it. it's that great moment. When you realize that you're a part of something very, very, very special, and you really begin to question, why are you in this room? The first year, 1995, when I was inducted, I sit at the table with Gail Sayers, Otto Graham, Bart Starr. I leave the room, and I got to call my father. You know, I grew up a St. Louis Cardinal fan and also a Green Bay Packer fan because they were on television most of the time. I still remember the Ice Bowl, 18 degrees below zero, and I thought that was the coldest day I'd ever, watch a football game until I played in one in Cincinnati, 59 degrees below zero, wind chill factor. So, but anyway, so I'm sitting at the table with these great legends, and it was called the Ray Nitschke Luncheon because Ray loved the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was the face, the heart, the soul, the spirit of that luncheon. And when he passed away, we named it the Ray Nitschke, and Deacon Jones drove that. And then, of course, Deacon took over in that leadership role. There's always a bet about who's going to be the first speaker to cry. And, it's usually the first speaker. It's usually the first speaker. But it's just a time for camaraderie. The picture that we take... I keep all those pictures in a nice photo file for my children and my grandchildren. And I still don't feel worthy to be in that room, but happy to be there.
Kellen went on then to be selected to the 75th NFL year team, one of only two tight ends. When we come back, we'll ask him about that honor. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Kellen Winslow, Sr. 1995 was a great year for you. You also were named to the 75th year anniversary team. You and Ditka were the only two tight ends.
Yeah.
How'd you find out, and what were your thoughts that night when you put your head on the pillow?
Oh, boy. They called. Someone from the league office, and... They send out a nice formal letter inviting you to be a part of, announcing that you're a part of the team and then inviting you to New York for the dinner. And they put out a book, a coffee table book, and I'm in that book. And we were in the room, all of us who were able to attend. Okay, Jim Brown, Gale Sayers, Bart Starr.
Bronco Nagurski,
Roger Staubach, Anthony Munoz in that room. And we're just Lawrence Taylor. We're just passing this book around. Roosevelt Brown. I love Rosie. Miss Rosie. And we're passing these books around like we're high school seniors getting our senior yearbook signed. Ted Hendricks. And just had a lot of fun doing that type of thing. You know, that was the same year in 95 that the University of Missouri retired my number. Number 83, along with Roger Worley, also in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and with Johnny Rowland. So it was just it was an unbelievable year for all those things to happen at one time. But my mother always said that, you know, my life has been a storybook life, to kind of get into football the way I did, to have the type of career I did on the teams that I did, and to end up in San Diego. And I'm just very humble and appreciative of that. But 95 was a great year, and that team is something that, you know, no one can ever take away from you.
The latest chapter in your glorious life, Kellen Winslow, is now as an ambassador for Madonna University in Livonia, Michigan.
And people always say, what are you doing at Madonna University in Livonia? My good friend Michael Grandillo became president last year, about a year by the time the running of the show, it'd be about a year for Mike to be out there at Madonna University. And I had worked with Mike on previous projects. He asked me to come up and help spread the word of Madonna, to let people know that Madonna University in Livonia, Michigan is alive and well. We got great programs in nursing. We've got great programs in criminal justice. We're known for that. We're growing our performance arts programs. And we've got a great location right there off the freeway, 20 minutes from the airport. And we're reaching into Detroit and trying to convince more people to come out from Detroit high schools, directly from high school, new first-time freshmen, and attend Madonna University. We've started new athletic programs. We've got plans on the board for new residential halls and doing things that are student-centered to improve the student experience. And when you do that and they leave with a degree from a noteworthy university and they've had a great experience, they become great donors.
Kellen, you've been an athletic director at Florida A&M and Central State University, so you've been around young people for a whole lot of years. What do our young people today really want deep down?
They want guidance. They want models. How do I become successful? They want to be able to tie into something that says, okay, if I do these things, I can be successful. Is no different than what we wanted. They may articulate it differently than we did, or they may bump into it in different ways, but they still want that structure and a path to success.
Speaking of they want models, talk to us about the job that these high school coaches and these college coaches do for young people today.
Well, they do a wonderful job. Of course, on the high school level, they're grossly underpaid. The number of hours they put in compared to the salary that they get. But that's for the entire teaching profession. It's grossly underpaid. We've got to get our priorities in order about K through 12 and what we're doing with our high school kids, not just in Detroit, but every place in the country, private school and public schools. But they are providing a great service to these young people by providing those models and that structure as a way to not, you know, go to college to play sports. If you go to play because you have the skill set to play at a Michigan, or you go to a Madonna because you have the skill set at that level to play, it's the experience that you really want. And that experience, they're providing that structure to have that great experience.
Certain teams, they just are always winners, it seems. The Patriots, the Cardinals in baseball, mm-hmm. Your hometown.
Yep.
Duke basketball.
Yes.
These legendary winning programs, what do they have in common?
They have a system. They have a structure. They have a value system, first of all. They know who they are, and they know what they do. Let's use the example of Baylor, what had just recently happened at Baylor University. Baylor University is an upstanding Christian university, Baptist. They have strong moral values. They have processes and procedures. Why did it break down? Because they stepped away from those values. And that's what caused all the trouble for the president, for the athletic director, and for the head football coach. They stopped being who they are. And you can't do that. You have to be real. Alabama has a system. They know what a football player looks like. It looks like an athlete. I don't care what position he plays. It's an athlete. And we only recruit athletes.
Speaking of a system and values, your faith has always been a very, very key point of your life. Why?
I was raised that way. And when I say faith, I'm not talking about particular religion. I'm talking about a belief in concepts that we're not as grand as we think we are. You know, as a matter of fact, we're very insignificant. That we're here to serve, not to be served. And that when we are serving others, those riches just come back into us, come back at us tenfold. And that's been the history of my life. I can't take credit for anything that I've done except for the fact that I've done the work. I've been put in positions by other people. I've been blessed to be around great people. And I think that God has always had a plan for me, and that plan was to be of service. And that's what we do at Madonna University. I was very attracted to the Franciscan values that they have, and I love being around the sisters.
As our time winds down,
mm-hmm.
What thoughts would you give to our young listeners tonight?
The thoughts are, let's go junior high school, high school. Your parents are not against you. I know you think that. I know they're trying to hold you back from something, but they're not. They've brought you this far. They're going to take you further. You're at that age right now where you think that you might know more than you really do, or that your friends are more important to you than those parents, those teachers. You have to believe, and you've got to trust that they have your best interest at heart, because they do. Your friends at this age will come and go, but your parents and your teachers are the ones who are teaching you those lifelong lessons that are eventually going to come into fruition and benefit you. You've got to listen to those individuals around you who are your parents and your teachers, not necessarily your friends, so-called friends.
Kellen Winslow, Sr., you're a Hall of Fame football player, but more importantly, a Hall of Fame man. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.